New York City. That's also where, well, never mind. Opinions are those of the speakers. Thanks for listening. It's labor hour at hand. And don't wear your hoodie up, even if it is raining, I guess.
Just not working clear. Hello, folks. Welcome to the March 24th, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour. Want to have everybody say hello to you this morning. We've got our great working class poet, Tom Thomas, here. Tom?
Hello.
And the original founder of the program, Bill Gorell.
Good morning.
And our great technical advisor and co-host, Bob Polesny.
Morning.
The World Labor Hour is brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and it's streamed worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management, its board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call area code 217-469-6111. That's Jobs with Justice, 469-6111. And this hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. The Democratic Union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
I'm your host today, Pat Simpson, and I've already introduced all the co-hosts here. We've got an excellent team. We're going to be looking at workers' interest news. Tom Thomas is going to tell us a little bit about what's going on in the world of labor. And later in the show, also, we'll have the Labor Hour Cultural Corner with one of Tom's poems. Tom's poem for the week is one from his Cries for Justice collection entitled Ireland is a Magic Land. We're getting back to the Celtic theme again.
A week late on that. I couldn't make it to the show last week, and I was going to do Ireland last week since it was St. Patrick's Day, but here I am a week late.
All right. It's better late than never, I always say, particularly when it comes to the Irish. So we will now talk a little bit about what's going on in terms of workers' interest news.
Okay, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has denied Illinois' appeal for disaster assistance in the wake of a deadly tornado and severe storms in southern Illinois, leaving counties, cities, and homeowners to seek other ways to recover from the damages. Seven people were killed when a tornado 200 yards wide and packing winds of 170 miles an hour swept through the Saline County town of Harrisburg on February 29th. The state had been seeking disaster declarations for Saline and four other counties affected by the severe storms, but FEMA concluded that homeowners insurance, charity organizations, and state funds could cover the costs of recovery. The decision was based on an assessment that 426 homes were damaged or totally destroyed. However, Governor Quinn and Illinois Senator Dick Durbin insisted that FEMA's rejection was totally out of touch with reality and was made before the storm damage was completely tallied. In its appeal, the state reported that the storms actually leveled or seriously damaged over 441 homes and destroyed 128 businesses in the poorest part of Illinois. Governor Quinn said in the statement, "I remain committed to obtaining any and all assistance available to help our southern Illinois communities recover."
Thanks, Tom. I got a story here that originally came out of In These Times by the author Roger Bybee. He talks about GE's warm and fuzzy ad campaign and ignores the U.S. job slashing. It says, no corporation has surpassed GE's mastery of profit maximization or its use of public relations to mask its true aims behind the widely supported goals of expanding scientific horizon, bringing good things to life, and rebuilding America's industrial base. But sometimes the profit maximization skills of GE's top executives and tax lawyers surpass the ability of its PR staff to put an appealing gloss on the company's conduct. For example, the disclosure that GE racked up $14.2 billion in profits in 2010 while paying no federal income taxes was not well received by the American public. GE not only avoided paying any taxes, but even managed to collect $3.2 billion in federal tax credits. This occurred against the backdrop of GE continuing to slash its workforce by 32,000 jobs from 165,000 to 133,000 over the 2004 to 2010 period. Kicking off with the Super Bowl, GE has been filling the airwaves with its ads aimed at not selling GE products to consumers, but at reassuring U.S. citizens that GE's driving mission is to meet human needs, provide deeply satisfying work to its employees, and revitalize America's manufacturing base. The ads don't mention that the corporation paid an average of just 2.3% in tax on its income over the last 10 years, according to Citizens for Tax Justice. In one ad, GE workers at Waukesha, Wisconsin Medical Equipment Division, which makes magnetic resonance imaging machines, x-ray machines, and other cutting-edge medical devices, are shown getting their much-cherished wish of meeting a busload of cancer patients whose recovery was aided by GE's medical products. Unmentioned, however, is the fact that GE has transferred the headquarters of the Medical Equipment Division to Beijing, China. Another one of the ads shows folks at the Louisville Appliance Park, and they see how GE employees in Louisville's Appliance Park are changing the way appliances are manufactured in the U.S. and how it's helping to create jobs. The ad includes a memorable scene where an African-American woman recounts how fortunate she was to find work at GE as it occurred after the plant where she had worked closed after 33 years. But GE conveniently avoids the big picture on jobs at Louisville. The Appliance Park has lost about 80 to 90% of its jobs over the last two decades. To its credit, the company is expanding the Louisville plant by about 400 jobs, but only after wage concessions by the union and up to $17 million in state and city incentives. Furthermore, the company claims it will create 1,300 jobs in the U.S. after a $1 billion investment in its appliance division is completed. Also, GE's Schenectady, New York steam turbine plant is a focus of a third ad. Again, there's some question as to whether these ads are really telling people the truth. Anyway, Tom?
Denying state assistance to tens of thousands of eligible students, the state of Illinois ran out of cash earlier than was expected for a college financial aid program. The monetary award program, known as MAP grants, are the primary source of need-based financial aid in Illinois, and the scholarship money is awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. This year, Illinois has received a record number of applications for the program. According to John Samuels, spokesman for the Illinois Student Assistance Commission that manages the program, what we have said consistently since January is that in all likelihood it will be the earliest cutoff ever. The grant money was depleted by students who applied between January 1st and March 13th, and this is the earliest the state has run out of funds for those grants. More than 140,000 students are expected to get the grants, which are worth up to $4,968 each. An estimated 140,000 other eligible students will be denied the grants.
Thanks, Tom. I got another story here out of Japan, and it's about Goldman's Muppet scan, it says. It says, a Goldman Sachs employee on Thursday recounted in a faltering voice how he toiled away in the back offices of the bank's Japanese operations for nearly a decade before being told last year that his job was being eliminated. He's now fighting back. At a news conference in Tokyo on Thursday, the finance professional said he and a group of former Goldman Sachs employees had founded a union to demand their jobs back in what lawyers said was a rare instance of organized labor in finance's highest echelons. "I would just like to be treated as a human," said the former employee, who said he was recruited by Goldman Sachs straight out of college and worked in operations before being laid off in August. He said Goldman Sachs representatives pressured him at combative meetings to take a six-month severance package, a sum he said was inadequate. He appeared at the news conference in a mask and refused to give his name or nationality, only saying that he was not Japanese and using the pseudonym Adam Lee. He said he was concerned that identifying himself would jeopardize his chances of getting future jobs in finance. And they're currently in discussions with the National Union of General Workers over a termination dispute. We're negotiating in good faith. Goldman's Japan office was set up in Tokyo in 1974 and employs about 1,300 people. Laid-off employees may have a strong claim of unfair dismissal in a country with some of the most protective labor laws in the world. Japanese companies have long been expected to offer their workers lifetime employment, a system long upheld as vital to the country's social cohesion.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Hey, as everybody knows, or most people know, this March is National Women's History Month. I've got a little thing here on the women's suffrage movement, which is women's history. The women's suffrage movement effectively began on July 19, 1848, when Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott conducted a women's rights convention at Seneca Falls, New York. It was the first such convention in world history. Susan B. Anthony gave direction to the movements, which formed and reformed repeatedly, always under her influence. With her guidance, women's groups successfully campaigned for voting rights at all levels of government. It was the initial introduction of the 19th Amendment, often called the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, in 1869, which gave impetus and coherence to the suffrage movement for 50 years. In those turbulent years following the Civil War, the 14th Amendment gave black males the right to vote, deliberately excluding females. Women then turned directly to the states for support and, with careful strategies, got 15 states to give them ballots. From that position of strength, they could begin their offensive on the federal government. National women's organizations were drawing some important women into their folds, and by 1920, the total movement had grown to include the new class of working women who had become a fifth of the total workforce. Until Alice Paul appeared on the scene, tactics were fairly genteel. However, in 1914, Alice Paul, impatient with the government's delaying tactics, brought a militant element into the movement. Soon, the police, with President Wilson's tacit approval, would respond with brutality. Women picketing the White House were roughly hauled off to jail, stripped naked, and thrown into filthy cells with syphilitic prostitutes. While there, punishment for even the slightest infraction of rules was terribly severe, as in the case of Ada Davenport Kendall, who, because she complained about the injustice of what was being done to them, was thrown into solitary confinement and fed nothing but bread and water for 17 days. There was an abundance of historic events that embraced the suffrage movement, but finally, conflict centered on the decisive 36th state needed to mandate the addition of the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution. Tennessee was that state, and on August 26, 1920, Tennessee delivered that 36th certificate to the U.S. Secretary of State, William Colby. With President Wilson's belated blessing, Colby hastily announced the historic decision, and women finally had the vote.
Great. I got one other story here from
Go ahead, Bob.
Inquiry finds ethics violations at the NLRB. A Republican member of the National Labor Relations Board improperly revealed information about the agency's private deliberations to outside parties who had cases pending before the board, an internal government watchdog said on Friday. The board's inspector general said the member, Terrence F. Flynn, violated ethics rules by sharing confidential details on the status of pending cases and likely votes of other members before decisions were released. This is a report from the Inspector General David P. Berry, also faulted Mr. Flynn for a lack of candor during the investigation. President Obama appointed Mr. Flynn and two others to the board in January. The report said Mr. Flynn actually committed the violations when he was still a staff lawyer at the agency before he was elevated to one of its five members. The NLRB oversees union elections and enforces rules on unfair labor practices. Its five board members, three Democrats and two Republicans, function much like judges on an appeals court, hearing cases and issuing legal decisions.
Okay, this is a press release from the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union. If you drive by a Panera Bread cafe on any given morning, you will be treated with the decadent smell of freshly baking bread and sweet goods thanks to the artful skills of Panera Bread Bakers. These bakers work from 10 p.m. each night to 6 a.m. each morning to make sure fresh bread, rolls, cakes, and other baked goods are carefully molded and baked in time for the early morning cafe opening. And if you were in Kalamazoo early this morning, you may have heard the joyful screams of Panera bakers celebrating their union victory. When the 18 bakers who are employed by the Bread of Life franchise, which owns all Panera locations along the I-94 corridor, southwest Michigan, decided that they had had enough of being improperly compensated as skilled bakers, they reached out to the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union, or the BCTGM, through the union's website, bctgm.org. The Panera bakers were concerned with inadequate medical insurance, insufficient time off, unsafe working conditions, and improvements to the bakeries that were being ignored by management. When 90% of the Panera bakers signed union cards, they approached management and requested recognition as a union. Rather than honoring their skilled bakers by recognizing them as a union, the owners of the Michigan Panera franchise, Bread of Life, hired a law firm to delay a union vote by claiming the I-94 division was not an appropriate unit. The National Labor Relations Board ruled that these bakers were indeed an appropriate unit and directed a secret ballot election to be held on Thursday, March 22nd. Bread of Life / Panera Bread also hired one of the largest known union-busting consulting firms to fight its own employees. One of the bakers told a union representative, quote, "I felt like we were prisoners of Panera rather than bakers of Panera. They would work for us all. They would work us all night and then force us to attend mandatory captive audience meetings in the morning." Another Panera baker recalls, quote, "They would keep us sleep deprived, hungry, and then cram us with anti-union Panera propaganda." It sounds like the Gitmo of labor relations there. The workers held together throughout 8 weeks of threats, intimidation, and other tactics used by management in an attempt to pressure the workers to vote against the union. Following the NLRB election on Thursday morning, which had voting at each of the six Panera Cafe locations in southwestern Michigan, the NLRB agents counted the ballots and announced that the workers had won by a 2-1 margin to be represented by the BCTGM.
Great.
Oh, that's great. Excellent news, yeah. And especially since it also means that I can continue to eat Panera goods now that they have indeed unionized. That's really, really fine news. I thought
I'd, you might mention that to the person at the counter, say that's why you're here. I'm here because
yes.
Some of your comrades in southwestern Michigan have organized.
That's right. An excellent idea, Bill.
It is
and I
excellent.
Think we should all do that. All you out there in radio land, hear this, and the next time you're in Panera, make a statement, something like that.
Yes.
I thought I'd add a little bit of humor in terms of the news today, and it's kind of another story following up on the Goldman Sachs debacle. There's a lot of fodder for a lot of further news with regard to Goldman Sachs, and here's the story. Goldman Sachs is looking for Kermit the Frog in its company emails. The bank is reportedly scanning internal emails for the word Muppet, Reuters reports. The scan comes after Greg Smith, an executive director at Goldman Sachs, resigned last week on the same day he published an op-ed in the New York Times, claiming that the company is profiting at the expense of its clients. Over the last 12 months, I have seen five different managing directors refer to their own clients as Muppets, sometimes over internal email, Smith wrote in the op-ed. It astounds me how little senior management gets a basic truth. If clients don't trust you, they will eventually stop doing business with you. In London, where Smith was based, the word Muppet isn't a reference to Miss Piggy or other puppets. Rather, it means idiot. So, here I am once again urging the Muppets of the world to rise up and throw off the contempt with which you are held by your financial advisors in the financial community.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. So Miss Piggy has triumphed. I think it's time we did a PSA announcement. Prairie Crosswords Blues Society has an upcoming show March 25th that will include Trent Romans, Terry Quaint, and the Sugar Prophets. It's going to be held at the Stop in Urbana at 3:30 p.m. And then coming up shortly thereafter on April 6th, First Friday Blues with Johnny Rawls. And it's a WEFT Blues Live at 8 p.m. Memphis on Main. That'll be at 10 p.m. And Prairie Crossroads Blues Society promotes the blues in each central Illinois. They can be contacted at www.prairiecrossroadsblues.org. Well, I think we've come to that time where we need a little culture above and beyond, of course, Miss Piggy. And so I wanted to get us started with our working class poet, Tom Thomas, and get him to give us a little reading about for St. Patrick's Day.
A week late, but still in honor of St. Patrick. Ireland is a magic land of beauty lush for all to see, created by her people's hand, an earthly paradise to be. From Dublin's cobbled alleyways to Knocknashiga's misty height, bright butterflies and singing jays and magic blossom day and night. Ireland has a living soul that even Cromwell could not turn, back when he played the tyrant's role, for which in hell he now does burn. Ireland is a magic land, a jewel in a turquoise sea, where people proud and ready stand when they've decided to be free. Aye, she did suffer in her times, as all her children sought to be, no longer victims of the crimes of an occupier's tyranny. Now there's no royal family to burn a witch or steal a farm. The Irish chose democracy to deliver them from that harm. Leprechauns dance in the clover, the willowed hills hide unicorns, moonlit nights banshees fly over, and fairies sing on golden morns. Ireland is a magic land of beauty lush for all to see, created by her people's hand, an earthly paradise to be. Ireland is a magic land was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois in the spring of 2007 and was brought to you live today, March 24th, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. Excellent poem.
Thank you.
And another public service announcement for us here. I want to remind you folks to tune in to Labor's View TV this Sunday and every Sunday at 4 p.m. It's on Comcast Cable Channel 6. And the hosts are one of our hosts of this show, David Johnson, and friend of the show, Jim Iman. That's Labor's View TV this Sunday and every Sunday at 4 p.m. on Comcast Cable Channel 6. And I think Pat's going to get us into a little bit of stuff from Hightower Radio.
That's right. I'm ready to give us a little of that wonderful man, Jim Hightower. And
Where's Woody when we need him? This year marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Woody Guthrie, and in these hard times of tinkle-down economics, we sure could use some of his hard-hitting musical stories and inspired lyrical populism. He wouldn't even need to write any new material. For example, just as in his day, our Wall Street banksters are getting rich, even as the victims of their narcissistic greed are getting pink slips and eviction notices. He already wrote about this outrage in his great old song, Pretty Boy Floyd, including this verse. Yes, as through this world I've wandered, I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six-gun, and some with a fountain pen. And as through your life you travel, yes, as through your life you roam, you won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home. Guthrie unabashedly celebrated America's working class, seeing in such people a strong commitment to the common good that lifts all of America up. This drove the powers that be crazy, a pretty short ride for many of them back then, just as it is today. So they branded him a unionist, a communist, and all sorts of other ists, but he withered them with humor that got people laughing at them. I ain't a communist necessarily, said Woody, but I have been in the red all my life. Going down those ribbons of highway that he extolled in This Land Is Your Land, Guthrie found that the only real hope for fairness and justice was in the people themselves. Woody preached that, quote, there is just one way to save yourself, and that's to get together and work and fight for everybody. Indeed, that's exactly what grassroots Americans are doing all across our country today. From Occupy Wall Street to the ongoing Wisconsin uprising, people are adding their own verses to Woody's musical refrain, I ain't gonna be treated this away. This is Jim Hightower saying, where's Woody when we need him? He's right there inside each of us. To save ourselves and our country, we must all be Woody.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Christmas time in Washington, and Democrats rehearse. I'm getting into gear for four more years. Things not getting worse. Republicans drank whiskey neat and thank your lucky stars. Said he cannot seek another term. There'll be no more FDRs. And I sat home in Tennessee, staring at the screen. An uneasy feeling in my chest, wondering what it means. Come back, Woody Guthrie. Come back to us now. And tell your eyes from paradise rise again somehow. If you run into Jesus, maybe he can help us out. Come back, Woody Guthrie, to us now. I followed in your footsteps once, back in my traveling days. But somewhere I failed to find your trail. Now I'm stumbling through the haze. But there's killers on the highway now, and a man can't get around. So I sold my soul for wheels that roll. Now I'm stuck here in this town. So come back, Woody Guthrie. Back to us now. Tell your eyes from paradise rise again somehow. If you run into Jesus, maybe he can help us out. Come back, Woody Guthrie, to us now. Says foxes in the hen house, and there's cows out in the corn. Unions have been busted, and they're proud red. red banners torn. But if you listen to the radio, they'll tell you all is well. Ah, but you and me and Cisco know it's going straight to hell. So come back, Emma Goldman. Rise up, old Joe Hill. The barricades are going up. They cannot break our will. And come back to us, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. Marching in the Selma. While the bells of freedom ring, come back, Woody Guthrie. Come back to us now. Tell us from paradise. Rise again somehow.
Well, that was really fine. I'm really glad to hear from Jim Hightower talking about Woody. Of course, he's so close by to Woody's native state.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but he spent a lot of time in Texas, too.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
In fact, a lot of the Bound for Glory movie, the beginning of it's in Texas before he goes to California.
Bill, you got a good memory. I wouldn't have remembered all
that. Well, I mean, I just watched it just recently.
And okay.
I'm actually remembering more from the book. Than the movie. The movie was just kind of sort of the middle part of his life. I would like to have seen it go farther after he went to New York and, you know, or maybe somebody could do a movie on that period with him and the, what was the singers? I can't remember now. But he was with a whole group of artists.
With Pete Seeger and stuff there.
Well, they were the Weavers, but I think you're right. There was
not the Weavers.
There was another group, and I can't remember the name
something
either.
Singers.
You know what we're going to have to do? Woody's birthday is coming up sometime in the summer, and I think what we need is to do a special show devoted just to the working man's troubadour is basically what he is. And it is really amazing. I was online recently just to see the many artists that have covered his songs, including I was really shocked to see Dolly Parton has done a version of the Los Gatos Canyon, which is, of course, the song about the immigrant workers, which is very relevant today.
You know, you're talking about Woody. I came about 20 minutes from meeting Arlo Guthrie when I lived in Vermont. Mm. Myself and Frank Pieper, I can't remember his last name, but we were doing a story on this factory in North Bennington that was putting trash in a reservoir there in North Bennington, and that was going into people's drinking water. So we were doing the filming there. We got back to the station. Everybody at the stations at Channel 12 TV in Bennington was just as excited as could be. It turned out that just about 20 minutes before we got back, Arlo Guthrie had been there. My secretary, Sharon Marshall, showed me this Polaroid picture of her sitting on his lap. I said, well, why didn't you keep him here? I said, why couldn't he? He had to go.
You were doing a story.
At 20 minutes, I almost met Arlo Guthrie.
You were doing a story about people throwing trash in a dump? And Arlo Guthrie was around?
No.
It didn't
North
have anything
Bennington,
to do with Alice's restaurant?
Everybody gets their drinking water from, and there was a factory there that was had pipes where that drained out like the sewage, drained into the reservoir, and that ended up in the drinking water, and that's what we were doing the story on.
Okay.
But Arlo didn't have anything to do. Arlo didn't have anything to do with the dirty water. It's just that he happened to be at Channel 12 checking it out because he was living in North Adams, Massachusetts at the time.
Yeah.
And he was just there checking out Channel 12. It was a community-based television station, just like WEFT is a community-based radio station.
I should mention that song was a Steve Earle song.
Yeah, and that is important. Another great troubadour.
Yes, and frequently does things on labor and stuff. And I think that song is titled Christmas Time in Washington. He had a little help there, I think, from Emmylou Harris singing some vocals along with him. So
Emmy was in town not too long ago, still in fine form.
Yeah.
At mentioning the West Alternative Radio Station, I think it's important for us to remind folks that we sure do like to see those contributions to WEF coming in. They can be made by calling 359-9338 or going online, weft.org. So keep those contributions coming if you like the programming that you're getting here. I was thinking, partly because recently I've been doing some teaching again, and finding that there's a common myth among the students, but it's not surprising because it's a common myth to be found almost anywhere in the United States these days, and certainly there are particular interests that like to promote this kind of myth, and that is the notion that unions have a negative effect on productivity, typically because if people are real honest about what they think about it, they think because unions protect lazy workers who essentially are not giving their all to the enterprise. And with that in mind, I started doing some research. Of course, I had some familiarity with some of these statistics and the like from some of the teaching that I've done. But I also want to urge everybody to comment on what I'm about to talk about, because people like, for example, Bill, who works in construction, has a very clear sense of the advantages of union labor when it comes to construction and the building trades. But in contrast to this myth...
Oh, yeah, by the way... And also, I would like to include, is he a senator? Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin.
Oh, yes.
As somebody who really appreciates unionization in the building trades, as his family is a large union excavation company in Wisconsin.
See.
And he is supported by building trades unions in that area. And he always votes in support of the Davis-Bacon Act.
Very interesting, yeah. Especially yeah. Given the particular budget that he just came out with,
exactly.
Which I think is actually going to be a disaster for the Republicans. I can't think what they're thinking about, given promoting that budget at this particular point in time. But just listen to some of these statistics on what the research really shows. According to a recent survey of 73 independent studies on unions and productivity, the available evidence points to a positive and statistically significant association between unions and productivity in the U.S. manufacturing and education sectors, all of you governors that would like to break the teachers' unions. And that is a productivity advantage of from 10 to 7%, respectively. That's what they get by looking at all these studies and averaging things out. Some scholars have found an even larger positive relationship between unions and productivity. According to Brown and Medoff, unionized establishments are about 22% more productive than those that are not. And in the best of these studies, what they do is they also control, that is basically cover themselves in terms of the question of technology and the size of the firm, because a lot of conservative economists will say, oh, unionized firms are more productive only because they have fancier capital equipment and the like, that's really what's going on. But the best of these studies control for this sort of thing. Another study looked at the relationship between unionization and product quality in the auto industry, and according to a summary of the study prepared by American Rights at Work, the author examines the system of co-management that's now operating in General Motors, for example, and this has not been the best of partnerships as of late, but at the Saturn Corporation, and the author credits the union with building a dense communications network throughout Saturn's management system, and it has had a very positive impact on performance and productivity. Unions also reduce turnover. As we know, turnover costs are a lot for firms, although depending on how much a firm uses unskilled labor and relies on unskilled labor, that may not be as much of an issue. And then finally, and I think you can see that there might be a relationship here between training and productivity, several studies have found a positive association between unionization and the amount and quality of workforce training. So there are a lot of myths out there, folks. This is one of the big ones, and it just simply isn't true when you look at the data.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not sure what it is with the auto workers, even though I could probably find it here with my computer real quickly. But I believe that they are somehow involved in paying for training as a union. Now, the building trades for sure are. You see, we have a fund that works in cooperation with the contractors, and I believe with the laborers, most things are maybe about 50-50. We have schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are three laborer schools in the state of Illinois right now. That's an increase of two. And basically what happens is we pay for our training and the contractors benefit from it. We're basically, and I, you know, actually tell you the truth, I'm definitely ambiguous about this, or ambivalent. I'm sorry, not ambiguous, but ambivalent. Because I think it may be giving too much away, but we do give a definite advantage to our contractors in that way, because they can call the local union halls when they come into town. For example, this Carl job over here,
mm-hmm.
you know, they got contractors who are coming in from Chicago. Well, they need somebody who can at least show up and do some halfway decent work, you know, and that's what they get. You know, or they might get somebody really good. They rarely get somebody who is just awful.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't have that particular study here, but I can recall from years ago, and of course they are somewhat dated studies, but nevertheless, where the highest productivity advantage in the unionized sector was in building and construction trades. And all you folks out there, I know sometimes you've had to have renovations on your home, and it's cheaper to get that non-union labor, but don't you pay a price. I certainly have on a couple of occasions.
with a lot of kinds of work. Now, see, when you're doing heating and air conditioning and plumbing and stuff like that and the electricians, especially in a town like Champaign, that's likely to be a union contractor you're dealing with, or the glazing contractors. But when it comes to other things like carpentry and so on and so forth, I mean, union contractors just – even though we do have, I know that the laborers has a separate contract for residential construction, which basically has a lower scale and a few things like that. I think it's about 75% of my scale. Union contractors just, they don't want to bid on anything small. In fact, several years ago, we had some work done on the front of the station here. And we had a real difficult time finding a union contractor that would do like a $30,000 job. We got somebody who was really good. I've worked for them before, and they were, besides being good at their work, they're a good contractor to work for, and that's Barber and D'Atley here in Champaign. Mm-hmm. They're a smaller company. Dave was working for them once a few years ago, and his boss got on him because he was working too fast.
His boss got on him for
yes,
that reason?
Yes, he said that this company, Barber and D'Atley, this is turning into a commercial. But they insisted that everything be, you know, see, most of what construction is figuring out what you can get away with. Because I've often been accused of doing too good of a job.
Hmm.
You know, it doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to be good enough. But except with Barber and D'Atley, it's got to be perfect.
All right. So it does sound a bit like a commercial. Yes.
And Jack, when's my check coming for that?
Well, we have to be particularly careful on that being a nonprofit organization. But
I mean, a lot of things also have to do, it's either not union or non-union. I mean, it's the culture that's created, you know, I guess, mutually between management and the workers and among the workers. And see, that's a different perspective I have in working. Like, I worked for 12 different contractors last year.
Hmm.
And it's just amazing how different things are from company to company. And over the last 30 years, I don't know how, I've worked for scores of different contractors. And some of them are great to work for, and they apparently make money and exist. Mm-hmm. And other ones are the biggest jerks in the world. And I guess they're just making that much more money.
Yeah, this question of culture is a really interesting one, because to me it also really aligns with other studies that have looked at why people unionize? Why workers, why employees unionize? And most people would say, well, of course you unionize. They unionize because they're interested in more money. Well, no, that's not what the studies actually show. The key in initiating organizing drives is a sense of not being treated with respect.
Right.
It's the working conditions. And yeah. I see working conditions or the issue of being treated with respect is very much part of what's the culture of a firm, you know?
Mm-hmm. What's interesting with the building trades is not only are almost all of the bosses people from the unions themselves, but the contractors are quite often union members. In fact, John Coleman, our local listeners would know John Coleman. He'll be on the show later today, I believe at 5 o'clock with his old time country. And John Coleman is an electrical contractor, and he was a member of the local electricians union. Mm-hmm. You know, worked as an electrician and then became a contractor.
Mm. Well, I got my start in labor education working for Local 3 of the IBEW in New York City. And almost all of the apprentices, if you asked them where did they want to be, 20, 30 years hence, they wanted to be contractors. I mean, it was sort of the sense that that's what you did. You know, you were a unionist, but then you became a contractor. So another angle I'd also like to mention on this whole productivity issue is this notion that it's unions that are to blame for U.S. manufacturing moving overseas. Well, I hate to tell you this, folks, but the reason that manufacturing is moving overseas, and there probably are several, but one of the key ones are average U.S. wages per se. It's not a question of just the unionized sector. It's a question of we in the United States have a higher standard of living, and that's one of the reasons why, on average, our manufacturing workers get paid more or have gotten historically paid more, although there's been some problems in that. In terms of competing with the possibility of overseas production, there's actually been a, shall we say, leveling off of average wages. But I think people have to really look at this question in terms of, do you really want to start having living standards that are similar to Indonesia? That's the real question here. So let's get off this sort of rag of it's unions that are causing this problem.
That was like the story I did last week where they were moving the garment factories just to wherever they could find the cheapest labor.
You know. And they're only paying those Chinese workers something like 31 cents a day.
Or less, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, another thing I think that's obvious from history, unfortunately not very many people care that much for history. But I mean, if you just look at Europe and the United States as the templates for industrialization, or as we call it now, development, actually you are developing an economy. And the thing that really upsets me about all this is that we have this history. We know exactly what to do. We know how to create a society where at least the overwhelming majority of people can live a fairly decent life, you know. And instead, what we do is we inflict the sins of our industrial grandfathers and great grandfathers, and you know, at that time they were mainly still fathers, and just, you know, having people working in awful conditions and so on and so forth. And we know that what you do is you know, and we had to have all kinds of upheavals and uproars and generations and decades of people living just awful lives and never having any security or anything at all until we finally reached in the 1930s a somewhat more humane system and economy. And it had a lot to do with unions and creating not a middle class, but a middle income working class, because that mm-hmm. is what really creates a modern industrial society that is decent to live in. And what we could help jumpstart it and have their own good internal markets on the same principle that, yes, they have to be able to make enough money to buy the products that they create. You know, that's right. Like the people at the
Even Henry Ford knew that one.
Yeah,
right.
That was the Fordist idea. But I mean, that's like the Foxconn plant. You know, those people, that one guy who does the show, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs,
you know, he was over there, and these people were just amazed when they actually got to see an actual iPhone.
Right, because all they were doing was working on an assembly line, and they'd never really seen the unit completed and knew what it did.
That's right, you know, just like the...
They'd never afford one.
That's right, just like Michael Moore's dad could always buy a new Detroit-made automobile while working in that industry every couple of years. Well, every Foxconn employee should have an iPad, an iPhone, and an iPod.
Exactly.
You know, be able to buy them.
But, of course, the great irony here is not only, shall we say, are American businesses implicated in essentially not providing good working conditions, a safe society, if you will, in other countries. But, of course, we're seeing the erosion of that post-New Deal improvement in the living standards of all Americans erode dramatically over the last 20 to 30 years, largely since about the 1980s, which I always see credit, therefore, as partly a function of Reagan economics. And we can go back to that.
Oh, actually, I think it goes back to around 1970. I think that's where it begins. There was some charts up recently on the internet that were really interesting that compared average workers' wages to things like productivity and so on from the beginning of the 20th century. And when you hit 1970, the wages flatten out.
Mm.
Everything up else, which is CEO pay, corporate profits, and productivity, just skyrocket, almost start going straight up at 1970. And what has happened, when I was in high school in the early 1970s, I remember teachers saying, oh, you guys will probably get to only have to work 4 days a week, you know, and because of all this technology and productivity. And that didn't happen. Instead, it went into the boss's pockets. And our standard of living declined both in terms of material, you know, the money we make, and also on the more roses side of the scene with us having to work more. We should only be working, I would say, 32 hours at most a week, and we should be making enough money where you can have your vacation, your health insurance, reliable transportation of some kind, communication needs fulfilled, and so on.
You need to feed the family.
Yeah, you know, and no work, you know, and be secure.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's enough money to do that in this country.
You know, the point you're making is a really good one, especially that about going back to the 70s. Unfortunately, we're running out of time now, and we want to make sure that everybody can hear the whole of Occupy the Air, which is coming up in just a minute. I also think I better mention that Dave Johnson was not here today because he's in a training for Jobs with Justice, and I'm sure we'll be telling us a little bit about what he trained and learned in Chicago. And also, I just want to mention that next week we're going to be having Harriet Morev, who is the president of the Campus Faculty Association, which is involved in an organizing drive right now at the U of I. So we'll be talking with her at that point. Again, this is the Labor Hour, WEFT 90.1 FM.